These stories await you at this year's Insect Fear Film Festival at the University of Illinois. Alien spiders destroy city. Giant mutant spiders threaten college journalism students. Far-fetched? Well, aliens are with us now. Asian longhorn beetle, European corn borer, Japanese beetle, gypsy moth, and many others. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, two scientists from the Illinois Natural History Survey share the lowdown on alien insect invaders. Our guests are Charlie Helm and Lee Ellen Solter. Lee is an insect pathologist. Charlie is a research entomologist. The survey is sponsoring an insect expo in conjunction with the Insect Fear Film Festival. This year's theme, alien insects, alien species, invasive species. The Insect Expo is this Saturday, February 9th. The expo begins at 1 in the afternoon and runs until 6 o'clock. That's when the doors open for the film festival. Listeners, I welcome your questions about insect invaders for entomologists Lee Ellen Solter and Charlie Helm. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Charlie, Lee, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks, Celeste. Pleasure to be here.
Now, where will the Insect Expo be held, and will it be at the same place or nearby the film festival?
It'll be right at the Folinger Auditorium where the Fear Film Festival will be held. And there will also be some displays at the Foreign Language Building, which is just across the sidewalk.
Okay, so there and nearby.
Right.
And what will we find at the Insect Expo this year?
Well, as usual, we will have the petting zoo. I think that's one of our most popular displays. Everybody loves to hold and play with big, big, ugly insects. We'll also have the predator-prey game, which is apropos to our alien insect focus this year. The butterflies that we'll be making with the young people who visit will be white butterflies, because our only alien butterfly in Illinois is the cabbage butterfly. And so we'll be making butterflies. We'll be doing insect tattoos, which are always very popular. Let's see. We'll be doing the bee waggle dance, and the alien species there is our own honeybee. The European honeybee is an alien species, but a good one.
A good one. There you go. That leads us to a question down the road here a little bit. But before we get to that, it sounds like the Insect Expo is going to be just a real hands-on. It's a real hands-on.
Right. Exhibit. Right.
What? Charlie, tell us about the Illinois Natural History and its mission, how long it's been around. Give us a little background on the job of the survey.
Well, the Illinois Natural History Survey is located here on the campus of the University of Illinois. We kind of proudly say that we've been here a little bit longer than U of I. In fact, we began our mission in 1858. Actually, Stephen Allen Forbes, the first state entomologist down the road, sort of got our mission going, and we're still dedicated towards monitoring the natural resources of the state of Illinois, looking for sound management practices and preservation practices for those resources, and sort of creating a history, so to speak, of changes in those resources, either naturally or man-made.
Mm. And tell us a little bit about what you do for this survey. You know, when somebody, you meet somebody and they say, well, what do you do? What do you tell them?
Wow. Well, the survey has four scientific departments. So they have economic entomology, biodiversity, wildlife, and aquatic ecology. And there are groups of scientists in each one of those departments that work on the various natural history and problem areas in the state of Illinois. When somebody asks me, I describe myself as an insect pathologist. I'm someone who studies insect diseases. And the reason I study insect diseases, partly what's here, what belongs in the state of Illinois, but also how we can use insect diseases to control alien species.
Very interesting. And Charlie,
responsibilities range from doing host plant resistance screening in soybeans to develop new varieties that might show natural resistance to insects that feed on the leaves, to monitoring, in my role as state survey coordinator, insects that are either new to the state or are very limited in distribution. Here we go with the alien species. Mm-hmm. New things that we may need to develop control practices to contain.
Yeah. Lee mentioned just a moment ago the European honeybee, which is an alien species, but a beneficial one. But I know, Charlie, you've worked with the Asian longhorned beetle, which is a very destructive introduced species. Let's begin with a very basic question. You know, how do you decide what's a pest from what's beneficial? You know, even though something might be native, I suppose, it could be a pest. And if something was introduced, it could be beneficial.
Absolutely. Not all of our introduced insects or introduced species in general are pests. Certainly, soybean is a prime example. Soybean is not native to North America. It's a very beneficial crop that we use, and it's not an invasive. It's something that we can contain, we manage it, and we do quite well with it. The honeybee is another example of a non-pest alien species that, of course, has proven invaluable in pollination. But something like Asian longhorn beetle or other alien invasive species, they arrive in the continent virtually with no controls whatsoever. When they left their native land by either purposeful introduction or accidental transport here, they arrive with no controls, and their population can virtually explode. They develop with no controls whatsoever, reach enormous levels, and cause serious damage either to agricultural crops or our ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. Or in the case of the longhorn beetle, aesthetic damage as
right.
well.
Right. The loss of trees in general in New York and Chicago. We often say, what's the price or what's the value of a city tree? And it's very, very hard to measure. Certainly, we have economic figures that we can give millions of dollars in loss because of the work and things that it took to actually remove these trees. But, you know, for an individual who lost a tree in the backyard, those are priceless.
Yeah, and some people lost all their trees, didn't
right.
they?
In some whole neighborhoods.
Yeah. Well, how might we define, then, invasive species? And is there a difference between invasive and exotic? And I guess, would the European honeybee be an exotic species?
It's exotic. Basically, exotic means any insect or any species that finds itself in a new place. We determine exotic usually by continental movement. Invasive means that those insects can expand beyond a range that makes them comfortable. It starts being a pest, so we sort of use the terms invasive and pest together. Where it impacts our ecosystems or impacts us as people, then we define it as a pest and define it as invasive.
Do we know how many species of invasive pest insects have landed, so to speak, in Illinois?
We're probably looking at nationwide thousands of different species. Now, not all of these are extremely serious pests. We often talk about a term that we use, the rule of 10. Let's say 1,000 species are accidentally introduced. Of those, about 10% may go on to actually become established, because it's very difficult for some of these new introductions to actually gain a foothold and become reproducing populations. Then out of that 10%, maybe be looking at only another additional 10% that actually go on to become very serious invasive species.
What are the most common invasive insect species in Illinois?
European corn borer would be
well,
one.
That's one of the oldest, probably,
right,
too.
Right. It's been here since early 1900s. Let's see. The alfalfa weevil is an introduced pest. Japanese beetle.
Oh, yeah.
And now we have gypsy moth in northern Illinois. So, along with Asian longhorn beetle.
How long does it, I'm sure this depends, you know, insect to insect, I mean, species to species, but how long can you generalize in how long does a species take to gain a foothold, and then how long does it take for a species like gypsy moth to migrate? It starts off in northern Illinois,
okay.
say.
Two big questions. Yeah. Some species take many, many years to establish themselves and aren't even noticed until they're can outbreak and be a pest. In a case like we experienced the last two summers with the Chinese aphid introduction on soybeans, that pest seems to have been introduced as late as 1998 in Wisconsin. and has managed to find its way all over the entire Midwest and has headed east and is now found in some of the eastern states and moving south. So that has been extremely rapid. Partly that depends on the ability of the insect to reproduce. And, of course, with aphids, they reproduce extremely quickly. And part of it depends on their ability to move. So with the gypsy moths, for example, the female gypsy moths are very large and egg-filled, and they can't fly. So the natural movement of gypsy moths is fairly slow. What happens with the gypsy moth is that people move it. Mm-hmm. And so most of the introductions and most of the fast movement west and south has been due to movement of people.
Now, how would I move a gypsy moth?
Well, let's say you go up to Wisconsin or Michigan during the summer, and you spend 2 weeks parked at an outdoor RV camp.
Uh-huh.
And during that two-week period, the females are laying eggs. Uh-huh. And they don't fly, but they can crawl. And you're parked next to a tree where the females are busy laying their eggs, and a few of them crawl up into your RV vehicle and lay eggs on the wheel axles or wheel wells. And you drive back home. And
I guess
later
in
the summer, those eggs overwinter, and the following spring they hatch.
Maybe I should wash the RV before I come back to Illinois, right?
Well, in fact, we have a poster out that to try to increase public awareness of this inadvertent hitchhiking mode of transport. And we do actually advise the camper or the homeowner who perhaps lives or visits an area where we know that the gypsy moth is established to actually take a close look at these materials before they bring them back, or even worse, before they move not only back into Illinois, but perhaps as far away as say, the Ozarks to set up camp once again. So you can see very rapidly here these things could be moved over hundreds of miles where it's humans that are actually doing the movement, not the insect itself.
Yeah, very interesting. And I also suppose that the wind can carry insects. I would think, especially like with an aphid that's really small.
Right. Aphid migration actually is a huge study of how they migrate through the upper air currents and can go hundreds of miles in a day on air currents.
Well, they get around.
They do.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking this afternoon about invasive insect species with two guests, two scientists from the Illinois Natural History Survey. Our guests this afternoon, Leolin Salter and Charlie Helm. Charlie's a research entomologist. Leolin is an insect pathologist. Listeners, your questions, your comments are welcome in Champaign-Urbana. Our telephone number, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else you're listening, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Are there other things we should be, are there other things we could be aware of? Are there things that we should be looking out for so that we don't become part of the problem? In terms of, like washing the RV before we, head off to the next campsite, a state away.
Gypsy moth is a prime example of one where we can be involved, but I guess on a grander scale, our first line of defense, of course, against invasive species is prevention. And so those of us who do international travel of any sort, I know you've probably all experienced returning home where you go through agriculture, and if you've been on a farm or if you're bringing in produce, there are very strict rules that govern the type of things that you can bring in because, of course, we don't want to inadvertently introduce things. It sounds far-fetched sometimes that, we shouldn't bring in an apple or we shouldn't bring in an orange, and yet there are documented cases of these being means of accidental introduction of new pests.
Mm-hmm. Well, you wouldn't want to bring an infected, medfly orange out of California, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
We've got a listener waiting to talk with us on the toll-free line in Belgium. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'd like to ask your guest a question. Has there ever been a case of where an invasive species has finally ran its course and stopped being invasive species, died out or was eradicated or whatever?
Oh, certainly. As I mentioned with the rule of 10, the vast majority of the accidental introductions really don't go on to become established pests. On the other hand, there are a few cases, and they are few and far between. We don't like to use the E word, eradication, too often. And I'm not promising eradication of the Asian longhorn beetle in Chicago, but we're moving in that direction, we hope. Populations there have diminished dramatically. It's very difficult to find adult beetles in the area. I think there were two that were detected last year. And this in spite of a very, very large survey effort that's being undertaken by the Illinois Department of Ag and the U.S. Department of Agriculture inspectors. We hope that we have eradicated it, but actually once these things are here and established, eradication is seldom effective.
So usually once they're here to stay.
That's correct. Again, European corn borer we mentioned is a prime example. It's an insect that wasn't known from Illinois until the 1930s, and we're battling it still. It's still our probably most serious above-ground corn pest, in spite of literally hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, that have been directed towards its control.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I have a question that must be on everybody's mind. How far south has the Asian longhorn already migrated, and when will it get here?
Well, as Charlie pointed out, the number of adult beetles that have been found over the past 3 years has diminished yearly. And last year, they only found two, and they were both still in the Chicago area. As far as we know, it has not migrated out of the Chicago area.
That's good news.
So far.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. You know, it seems to me you'd also have to be enlisting the aid of other states in order to keep a handle on, you know, what the populations are and what migration might be,
right,
you know, in the wind, so to speak.
Right. Well, I think the soybean aphid has been a case in point because it was discovered 98 in Wisconsin, 99, last 2 years.
Right.
Was found in Illinois in 2000 for the first time. And basically, both scientists, entomologists, and other biologists in Illinois formed a very quick group of taxonomists, of epidemiologists, of field-level biologists, soybean experts, virus experts, soybean virus transmission experts, because aphids can transmit viruses, put them together in a very short period of time and started looking at what was going on in Illinois. You know, whether the aphid could overwinter, did we have the overwintering species, which we did. It's a buckthorn, unfortunately. But other states have done the same thing, and those efforts have also been coordinated between the states. So scientists are communicating both individually and as groups between the Midwest states.
Are there effective controls at this point for the soybean aphid?
Right now, the only thing that's been used are some chemical controls, and the insecticides that are used regularly on soybean for other pests were effective in very small plot studies. Last year, the soybean aphid didn't outbreak very severely in Illinois, so we don't have particular tests from last year.
Has it shown up pretty much statewide?
Pretty much, yeah. It's more severe in the north, less heavy populations in the south, right?
Yeah. But here again, this is an insect that, if I'm remembering from the little bit of information that I read about it, you can see 18 generations within the space of a year.
That's correct. The reproductive potential of this insect is just enormous, and it has a very complex life cycle. We won't go into all the gory mm-hmm. details of that, but it does use, as Lee referred to, an alternate host, buckthorn, a rhamnus species, which of all things is also an alien species, and is a problem in some of the natural areas in the northern part of the state. So we have here a situation where actually all three species in this relationship, soybean is an exotic to a certain extent because it's an introduced species. It's mm-hmm. not an invasive insect or an invasive plant, but we have an invasive insect, the soybean aphid, and its alternate host, an invasive shrub. So all three species are actually exotics in this case.
Now, this is the Chinese soybean aphid, so it came from China. How did it get here?
Not sure. The most likely scenario is that it came in on ornamentals that were shipped to nurseries. Mm-hmm. But that hasn't been mm-hmm. that hasn't been proven.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk with some other listeners. Next we go to Lovington, a listener on line one. Hello.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Have any of the radiation treatments work with any of these insects, like it has the screw worm in the southwest?
Not any of the ones we're talking about. We haven't, for one thing, rearing Asian longhorn beetles is very difficult to do in the laboratory, and it can only be done under quarantine conditions. So there are very few places in the U.S. where that can happen. So in order to get up and running on some kind of male sterilization techniques would be very difficult, and we're certainly not there yet with that species.
Well, I was thinking more in terms of the corn borer.
Oh, the corn borer?
Yes.
Not to my knowledge. I don't think irradiation has at least been ever developed commercially for European corn borer.
Okay. Has it been tried for anything else other than the screw worm in the southwest with any effect?
Not that I'm aware of. And this kind of gets out of my area to a certain extent, since we're a little bit more specialized in actually monitoring, surveying, detection for some of these pests. But I'm really not aware of any other prime examples other than the screw worm that you mentioned where this has been a very effective technique.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. So what was the host plant in Europe for the corn borer? Was it corn?
Well, corn is a New World plant, so right. It was originally grasses and some other smaller forbs, but primarily grasses, and of course corn is a grass.
Corn is a grass.
So when corn went to Europe, the corn borer was able to utilize it in Europe and then was reintroduced here on broom corn, actually, in about 1917. The broom corn industry brought corn back from Europe. That had these things do just fine in a dry stalk, and so they came back from Europe in the corn.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener on line two in Bourbonnais. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I have two questions. One's about Japanese beetles, and the other is about classifications. They say when people move to a small town, they're never, ever considered natives. And some of the things you've said about some insects makes me wonder if that same kind of thing isn't going on. How long do you have to be established in an area before you become native? I mean, wherever a honeybee came from, aren't they native to this area now?
In scientific terms, no. As long as you know the area of origin, and sometimes we don't, but as long as you know the area of origin, if it comes from someplace else, then it's considered an exotic. Now, that doesn't mean it's exotic and detrimental. It can be exotic and beneficial, as we consider the honeybee. But in general, we have what we call established pests that are never going to go away. And as long as we have corn, we're going to have the European corn borer. As long as we have oak trees, we're going to have the gypsy moth. They are established, but they are not considered native in scientific terminology.
Okay.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Yes, go ahead.
I'm not sure that this question about Japanese beetles is within the scope of the day's discussion.
Well, give it a try.
Okay, what do I do about them?
That's the million-dollar
question.
Yeah. They're a difficult insect to control. And we can go back to the days of Rachel Carson and before, where there was reference made to the wide-scale efforts to eradicate this thing with aerial sprays of DDT. It's still with us. The homeowner, there are a few chemicals, and I think it would be best here to consult your extension personnel to get the exact list of approved chemicals for treatment, but there are products available to treat some of the ornamentals in the backyard. There's been a milky spore disease that's been used to a certain extent for controlling grubs, but you're right, we find this a very difficult insect to control, and probably would caution also against the use of the beetle traps. The beetle traps are very effective. They'll draw the Japanese beetle in.
From but, everybody else's
right,
yard.
I'd maybe give them to all my neighbors and let them attract the Japanese beetle to their backyard rather than mine.
How big of a yard do you have?
Well, it's pretty darn big. The front is probably 20-30 yards deep.
Do you have a lot of different plants that are attracting the beetles, or just a few?
Well, what they come to is some sort of currant bush.
Uh-huh, okay.
And they just...
They love it.
Yeah.
You know what I do? I have a few roses in my yard, and they really love roses, too, and a few other things. What I do is take a bucket of soapy water and go out into the yard and pop the beetles off the bushes. They'll drop. If you touch them, they drop. And just put them into a bucket of soapy water.
Yeah, I do something like that, too. Yeah. I have it's a little more gruesome. I have a couple of blocks of wood, and I just...
smash them. They are less attracted to the plants when there are no beetles on the plant. So there's actually something going on that beetles on a plant attract more beetles.
So eternal vigilance is the price we pay.
Right. There are, as Charlie pointed out, some chemicals that you can use that are cited for... Japanese beetles, but you need to be very careful about that because some of those chemicals, including carbaryls, I believe, are very dangerous to other insects, especially honeybees.
Yeah. So. Well, what about going after the grubs?
Well, there is a biological control called milky spore disease.
Milky spore disease?
Disease. It's a bacterium. And this milky spore bacterium is pretty specific to the Japanese beetle grubs. The problem with it is that it's fairly erratic. I mean, it's another biological organism. And sometimes it takes up to 3 or 4 years for the beetles to be affected. But you can pour this into the ground surface, you know, in the evening when it's cool and damp. If the grubs get infected and you do gain control, then that can actually last for up to 20 years. As I said, it is very erratic. It's not something you can really count on, but it is a good biological control that's very specific to the Japanese beetle. You can buy it. It's called Doom.
Doom?
Doom is one of the... one of,
is there
one
a skull of, and crossbones on it?
Probably. I doubt they'd want you to drink it.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Sure.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. I think it's very interesting that a plant with Japanese beetles on it draws other Japanese beetles. Isn't that interesting? Are there any ideas about what's going on? Is there...
It's probably, it could be one of two things, and actually I'm not sure about the specific situation, but either the plant responds to the damage by the initial beetles, which are drawn to the plant by the plant's caromones or the pheromones that the plants give off, or the secondary plant compounds that attract the beetles. So either the damage to the plant itself causes release of some more of those chemical cues, or the beetles themselves may have a pheromone, and that I'm not sure about, an aggregation pheromone where it draws in other beetles.
Really interesting. Let's talk with another listener on the toll-free line in Crawfordsville. Hi there.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Excellent. I'm fighting the same good fight against the Japanese beetle. In Japan, do they have a natural predator?
That's a very good question, and that is often an approach that we take. But to my knowledge, we have not been able to find anything effective in its native land to introduce here, which, of course, gets into a very controversial area, whether or not we want to use another exotic insect or another exotic species to control one that is already present and established here in a new country.
Right, the rabbits in Australia syndrome, yes.
Right, so I'm not aware right off the top of my head of anything that we might be considering as a biological control from the country of origin.
Right. One of their big predators are birds, and that's something we're certainly not going to import. Importing vertebrates can be really problematic.
Yeah, well, and I'm disappointed in the native birds. They don't seem to care about them, and they're in great gobs and bunches. And yet they've got to be a nuisance commercially for orchardists because they will hit fruit tree leaves.
Right.
What's done commercially to keep? Do you just keep spraying 7 once a week or what?
Well, 7 is one of the things that you probably want to avoid if possible because it does have effect on honeybees. But there are several chemicals that are a lot less damaging to beneficial insects that can be used in orchards and in yards for that matter. I would suggest that you contact your local extension agent about which ones.
Purdue says 7 and Malathion. Now, give me a good Illinois answer now.
Well, I'm really not sure which would be the
best.
Back to milky spore disease, I suppose.
Well, but see, I'm incensed by it because I don't have any lawn, and that's for the grubs to live in, so they're doubly invasive. They're coming from somebody else's lawn.
Right, and attacking your roses, right?
Yes, and fruit trees and everything else. But what would be a less problematic chemical to use?
I'm trying to think of the name of it. It's a, this is not a a commercial name. Methachlore, I believe, is, and there's several commercial products.
But methachlore, huh?
I believe so.
Well, I can go look at the contents then. I thank you very much.
Welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. We have about 15 minutes left in the program. Two guests are with us this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, Lee Ellen Salter and Charlie Helm. They are both scientists with the Illinois Natural History Survey, and they're here to talk with us this afternoon about invasive alien insects. When you come up against a problem and you're trying to figure out how best to control it and not hurt other species, like, for example, those poor folks in orchards trying to deal with the Japanese beetle, they don't want to hurt the honeybee because the honeybee is going to be a pollinator for their fruit. How do you go about, you know, thinking through the problem and what might be an appropriate solution? And under what circumstances do you begin to think about introducing another species?
Well, that's one thing I actually do in my laboratory, being an insect pathologist. One of the things I look at in terms of insect diseases is what might be the appropriate disease that, if it isn't already introduced with the pest when it comes to North America, might be introduced from the native range. And so that's always been a cornerstone of biological control, of classical biological control, is looking at what the pathogens, predators, and parasites are, all the natural enemies in the area of origin, and trying to determine if some of those can be released here. Now, if you're talking about birds or mice, or usually vertebrates are a no-no. We don't want to introduce vertebrates here that will displace native species. When you get into parasites, and usually what we're talking about is very tiny parasitic wasps and flies, then you ask the same kinds of questions that you would ask with insect pathogens or insect diseases. And that is, if we were to bring them here, could they harm native species? And so there are some pretty extensive testing, and it's really the major issue that we're dealing with some of these things. With insect pathogens, for example, they're not going to hurt vertebrates in general. They're specific to insects, but you certainly don't want to bring in a pathogen that's going to kill the monarch butterfly if you're trying to control the gypsy moth. And so our work is primarily involved with looking at whether these diseases can be transmitted to other insects, and if some of those insects are beneficial. So most of the work in the laboratory is determining how effective the disease is, and if it's effective, and if it's shown to be effective in its native range, is it something that we can safely bring here?
Let's talk with another listener. On line one in Champaign, hello. Is a caller there on line one? No, let's go to line two. Another listener in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi. I have another question about the Asian longhorn beetle. Does it have a predilection for any particular species of tree?
Yes, absolutely. In China, where it's native, it's been absolutely devastating to monocultural stands of poplars. Also prefers maples. In fact, in China, they use the maple tree as a trap tree to try to lure the insect away from the more prized, in the case in China, the more prized poplars. So when it was introduced here into the U.S., maple trees quickly became one of its favorite. Box elder is another, and horse chestnut has suffered quite extensively in the New York infestations.
All cultivars of maples?
Pretty much all cultivars. They love the softer hardwoods. Oaks, on the other hand, are not a particularly good host for Asian longhorn beetle. On the other hand, the sad state of affairs there is that gypsy moth happens to like the oaks. So we've got a double-barreled approach here in some of the northeastern part of the state.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. I will also imagine that as northern Illinois, that areas that have been hit by the beetle are trying to reforest, that's got to be a problem too, because if they like the softer woods, those are generally your If I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong about this, but aren't softer woods a faster-growing tree?
For the most part, correct. And that's why, of course, our maples are one of the more common street trees. They're very fast-growing. They tolerate some of the more extreme environments that they're likely to encounter in a cityscape situation. So it's been difficult. But there are a list of approved trees that in the reforestation process in Chicago they're using. Actually, things like bald cypress, linden, some of the oaks that we mentioned that the Asian longhorn beetle doesn't prefer. But again, we're putting that back into an environment where we may be facing a developing gypsy moth situation. But we're looking here again to replace these trees with not a monoculture as we've had in many cases of maples after maple after maple down a street, but a variety of trees that the Asian longhorn beetle is going to find less attractive.
Sounds like the scientists at the survey, whether it's in biology or entomology, have to work really closely together.
Well, not only together, but with scientists and officials from other agencies. So we work closely with Department of Agriculture, both federal and state, with the U.S. Forest Service, with different even growers groups, with the crop situations. So. We have to have a lot of collaborative kinds of research.
What kind of progress has been made in terms of heading this critter off, you know, at its source? If I'm not mistaken, the Asian longhorn beetle arrived probably in pallets, shipping pallets?
Correct. This is pretty well documented. I think without question the solid wood packing material has been proven to be an enormously successful pathway for a lot of wood-boring and wood-inhabiting species. After the introduction of the Asian longhorn beetle in 1996 in New York and then the subsequent find of it in the Chicago area in 1998, an interim rule went into effect to more closely regulate and restrict the movement of solid wood packing material from areas where we know that, for instance, Asian longhorn beetle is established. So This quickly goes into a big geopolitical issue then with worldwide economies involved. Officials from China were quite concerned and upset about this restriction because certainly the rules that went into effect that called for either kiln drying or a methyl bromide fumigation or some preservative treatment of this wood is definitely going to increase the cost of the goods that are shipped using these type containers.
Let's talk with another listener calling us this afternoon from Indiana. Hi there.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, how are you?
Not too bad at all. I heard the comment about the longhorn beetle's attraction for maple trees, and I was thinking about the problem people are having with Japanese beetles. I've noticed that Japanese beetles also have a preference for a common weed. I believe it's Polygonum or smartweed. If you want to track them away from your roses, just leave a few of those weeds in the corner and the Japanese beetles will congregate there.
So it sounds like you've got a really nice trap plant.
Well, they seem to like it better than anything else in my garden, I just leave them a little snack.
Right, that's a good idea. They have, and then you can put them in the bucket of soapy water.
Yep, exactly.
They do have a host range of about 300 plants, so it's pretty hard to have a yard that doesn't have at least one of those in it.
Well, I've observed that they really like my polygonum more than they do my roses or my raspberries. I just leave a little snack on the side.
It sounds like a good idea. Some of the other listeners might want to take your cue there.
Well, I hope it works for them. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Let's talk about the multicolored Asian lady beetle, which is another thing that seems to me this is a fairly recent introduction, is it not?
That's correct. Until 1994, we had not seen this insect in Illinois. Now, we can get into a very controversial area here because, in fact, this insect was, and not by the University of Illinois, not by the state of Illinois, but it was actually purposely introduced into the U.S. as a control for pecan aphid. As early as 1916, there were some introductions that were made. It's an interesting insect. It's a little bit bigger than our common lady beetle, as most listeners are probably well aware, since they've undoubtedly seen some of these in their homes. But it rapidly has expanded its range and has become a little bit of a bad guy to a certain extent. It's certainly been effective controlling the pecan aphid. In fact, we've also seen it doing some real serious damage to populations of soybean aphid over the last couple of years. But unfortunately, they have this really unpleasant habit of searching out our homes in the fall for a nice warm place to spend the winter. And we've had individuals call in who've literally said that they've swept these things up in dustpans to get them out of the house. So they've kind of given a little bit of a black eye to a well-intentioned introduction.
Yeah, I haven't seen that many in the house, but every once in a while I'll find one. And the interesting thing that to me, it seems that I seem to find them right when it's really, really cold. Not when it's about to get cold, but right after or right during a cold snap for us. So I guess they've spotted the, you know, some way to get in, and they've figured out that inside there is warmer than it is out here. So how do they multiply? What turns them on, so to speak?
They're overwintering right now as adults, and as you mentioned, on maybe in your garage even on a nice warm day, and we've had a lot of those, of course, this winter. You'll see these things crawling around. But come the spring, they'll lay their eggs, and there'll be larvae look quite unlike the lady beetle. These are insects that undergo complete metamorphosis, and oftentimes the immature stage looks nothing whatsoever like the adult. The larvae are also very ferocious predators, and so they're in a sense a beneficial insect, and they do a good job on a number of other pest species. These things then mature, pupate, and become adults. We'll see those later on in the season that look just like the ones that we've got in the home right now. Again, very effective predators, but unfortunately for some of our native species of lady beetles, they're a little bit larger, they reproduce a little bit quicker and more successfully, and we actually think that there may be cases where they're out-competing some of our native species of lady beetles. So again, not a terribly, terribly harmful insect, a bit of a nuisance, but they've had an impact on our own native species, and we'd rather sort of keep things the way they were. This is an introduction that maybe was not as well advised as some of the other attempts at introducing non-native species to control pest problems have been. It's far too generalist an insect. And when Lee was referring to before some of her testing with biological control agents, specificity is the key. And this is not a specifically host-specific insect. So I think that's kind of led to the problems that we're seeing now.
What's the latest on the Asian tiger mosquito? I know for a while that this was of great concern in the state of Illinois, but I understand that there have been some things done, and the battle is being waged. And well, how are we faring against the tiger mosquito, which is a pest to humans? It's a disease vector.
Right, it's a disease vector. So that's the biggest problem. I think most of the control right now is looking at the waste tire problem. Because they do tend to lay their eggs in pools of water above the ground, so waste tires are a big problem. There is a lot of work being done on, of course, the diseases that they vector, and determining whether that's a problem with the species that are in Illinois at this point or in the U.S. at this point.
So also, would we see this, places where they're discarding tires is going to be a big problem. But would this be a problem in standing water, areas of standing water in the home landscape, this mosquito?
I believe it could be, as long as the water source doesn't dry up.
So they are cavity inhabiting, and so like a little pool of water probably on the ground, that's not going to be the case. But we do know that they'll use tree holes in forested areas. So they're naturalizing a bit, so to speak.
Okay, very good. I think we're out of time. It went very quickly. I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us this afternoon. And let me remind folks that this weekend on Saturday, big insect expo in conjunction with the Insect Fear Film Festival. The expo festivities will begin at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday and run through 6 p.m., and that's when the doors open for the Insect Fear Film Festival. The expo will be held in the lobbies of the Foreign Languages Building and Follinger Auditorium. Follinger, of course, auditorium where the Insect Fear Film Festival will be. And our thanks very much this afternoon to our guests from the Illinois Natural History Survey, Charlie Helm and Lee Ellen Salter. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome.